This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning. I was just recollecting when I was working at Larkin Street Youth Center quite a few years ago, and at that time it was on Larkin Street, and for all that it was not always easy to see whether we were or how we were being helpful to many underage kids who passed through the door, at least we were helping to keep them fed and sheltered, and whenever possible effect a rapprochement with their families. So it was felt like good work. And then one night the very, very sweet man who was the custodian was there by himself, and a fire broke out. And we had a pretty large collection of like clothing and towels and so forth. It was very inflammable. And he was overcome in the smoke and died. And the place was effectively destroyed. So this was a big shock to the staff and the kids, and a terrible shock to the family of the man who died. And I suppose this is being brought to mind because of circumstances not so far away, where people have been killed and homes ruined. And probably, goodness knows how many millions of dollars of damage done. So, Buddhists, you know, we can wag our fingers and say, impermanence, told you. But that doesn't really cut it. We were, we heard about the fire. At the youth center, you know, the staff, all the staff basically just showed up. This was late at night, but we all showed up, and we were just sobbing. And it was an opportunity, of course, to see where's practice here? And it's probably just as well that you can't really point to anything and say, oh, there it is. Earlier, I was browbeating Hokai-san about reading the collection of Suzuki Roshi's lectures on the dedicatory verses used during chanting service. And it includes, in addition to his lectures, a lot of question and answers from the students. So it's actually quite an important document. And I highly recommend it, even though it's a transcript. So it has Suzuki Roshi's peculiar diction, but you can get used to that pretty easily. Anyway, I forget what somebody asked him, but he said, I think someone was asking, what's the point of this? And Hokai-san, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the student said, if I keep chanting, will I like enjoy it at some point?
Will
it be helpful for my life? And Suzuki Roshi said,
life,
yeah.
Life.
Mm-hmm. Suzuki Roshi said, yes, it will. And he said something like, it's not that you'll necessarily, you may not have some understanding, some particular understanding, but you will feel something. And that feeling will tell you that your life is engaged in this practice. That your life is touched, that you touch life. And again, there is not very much to hang on to in terms of our intellectual positioning. And you also can't tell someone else what that feeling is, what that sense is. Maybe, Suzuki Roshi spoke English. He'd studied English a long time, but he wasn't exactly fluent. So maybe he might have chosen some other words if he had been speaking less extemporaneously. Feeling is one. That's okay, but maybe sense is another word. To have some sense that practice is happening in the midst of life. So standing on the sidewalk, one of my coworkers and I were sort of leaning on each other and weeping. There was a sense that practice was present somewhere. And that affected the bitter taste of what was happening right then. Still bitter, but also something else. Basically, no sense of at least for me, that oh, God has betrayed us, and life is one miserable disaster after another, and why bother, and so forth. That was not present. At least, I don't think so. This is, as I say, this was a long time ago now. This was 86, 87, something like that. So, people nearby here are in a very painful situation. And we can help in some material ways. Hokai-san put out a, you may see there's a box up there for food contributions. There are a number of ways like that we can be helpful. But there also needs to be space in whatever we're doing for this ineffable sense, this presence in our life of practice. It's not that we should go looking for some particular feeling, so I want to stress that, that this really isn't any different from what from the instructions we usually give. It's like, well, you know what, you just, the foundation is being present for what's happening. Somebody on Facebook posted an article, maybe is it Newsweek or something? Anyway, sort of like mindfulness overhyped, you know, or snake oil for sale, mindfulness, you know, something like that. And anyway, some people did some research and think they've discovered that it's actually not all that helpful. And I mean, we could have told them that. I didn't read their article all that carefully, but anyway, somebody did some research and found that. Well, this is one of those things in social sciences where someone researches other people's research. So they went and looked at all of these various studies and found that a lot of them had poor methodology and so forth, and couldn't really justify their conclusions. So I feel a little self-conscious if I say, you know, being present for what's happening now. So it's like, well, that's what they teach in those mindfulness weekend things that you sign up for and pay a fortune for, and supposedly your life will never be the same. But that an instruction like that goes way, way back before any recorded human history. No one will ever be able to say when humans discovered that some kind of introspection really affects our life. Who was the first human to introspect? Nobody knows. But it's pretty clear that by Buddha's time, it was well established. And of course, the from our perspective, the point is to be an instrument for the liberation of all beings. And for that to be true, we need to have some broader perspective. Buddha's teaching, as we know, is pretty clear. Most of the complication in fact, all of it, as far as I can tell, came subsequently. When, in our human way, it was fun to tinker with things, so people started tinkering with Buddha's teaching, seeing what they could make it do. But basically, it's fairly straightforward. So we're told that there is basically nothing to attach to. I'm sure you've all heard that before. That attachment is always based on illusion and misknowledge. And for reasons that maybe can't really be mechanically explained, sitting still, bowing, chanting, making offerings, all of that is in accord with the fact that there's nothing that can be attached to. Even celebrates it. The late abbots, one of the late abbots' wonderful poems. He says, he's talking about our Chinese ancestors, and he says, their world and several other sins gone to hell in a handbasket. They knew it, cheered as it whizzed by. That's kind of our job, is to cheer as it whizzes by. And in the midst of our relatively simple practice that we have here, try not to be impatient with teachings like Master Pan Chan, who's a disciple of Master Ma, who said, throughout the three realms, there's not a single thing. Where does mind abide? The four gross elements are fundamentally empty. Where does Buddha live? The North Star doesn't move. Still and silent, without traces. Meet it face to face. And you see there is nothing further. So from the ordinary perspective, to say that throughout the universe there's not a single thing is, I assume it's a little startling, although not to you guys. Of course, what he means is there's not a single thing to be grasped. whether that's very sad news or very glad news kind of depends on your perspective. Master Shui Do wrote a poem about this utterance of Pan Chan's. He says, throughout the triple world, not a single thing. Where does mind abide? White clouds form a canopy. A clear spring forms a lute. One melody, two melodies, no one understands. After the rain, the autumn water is deep in the evening pond. Our Chan ancestors love to do this, you know, sort of turn us in circles. And then point into the far distance. And eventually, what is most profoundly human about us knows itself in that vastness. This is some feeling that Suzuki Roshi mentioned. And what can you do with that? Well, you can stand on the street with your coworkers and sob. That's one thing. And we may feel, you know, some frustration that you can't give it to somebody else. The great Tang Dynasty poet Su Tongpo, very, very famous poet. One of his celebrated verses speaks of this situation. He says, the sound of valley streams is Buddha's great speech. The colors of the mountains, the true body. Since evening, 84,000 poems next day, whom can I tell? So eventually those maybe peculiar dedicatory verses that we use, they merge into the 84,000 poems that are constantly pouring forth. And maybe you can't wrap them up and give them to somebody. But maybe you can help someone by drawing their attention to the vast distance. And then the pressure that we feel as human beings, you know, the squeeze, is revealed to have, well, maybe not just one other dimension, but many. After the rain, the autumn water is deep in the evening pond. It's just a poetic image, right? But it points into the unreachable distance. Any of you have friends or family who are in trouble because of the fires? Yes? No.
Also a heart loss.
Oh. Sorry. Well, I have a distant cousin who lives up there with her family. They're apparently okay, but speaking of artists, an artist fellow who used to see at Thanksgiving very often, he lost his whole studio and all his collected paintings. So even if in all the triple worlds there's not a single thing, those words are not enough. To ask any questions.
That's just where kind of some thoughts were, you mentioned about mindfulness kind of being debunked recently or something, which I think is pretty funny.
Yeah, it is, but actually.
For a number of reasons, it's like, I think there are a number of problems with that. First of all, of course, I think there's a lot of bullshit that's being peddled as mindfulness and marketed as people like, try mindfulness for just $99.99.
Yeah, right.
You won't have any more problems in your life.
Right.
Mindfulness cures cancer. Mindfulness, whatever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm sure it's getting inflated, what it can do, but it's like, at the same time, for like thousands of years, people have been doing it, and are still doing it.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, I've heard that in Theravada monasteries, monks still, they have the Satipatthana Sutra under their pillows. They sleep with it under their...
Yes.
So anyways, I mean, I think it's helpful, but it's like, I mean, the other thing that makes me think is it's like, it's helpful in ways that I think aren't so easily quantifiable.
Right.
And then here's this research, they're saying, wow, we can't prove it. Where's the evidence, you know?
Right.
But I was just watching that Ken Burns documentary on the Vietnam War. They're trying to quantify everything the entire time.
Right, the whole time. What a mess.
Vast amounts of paperwork that nobody knew what to do with.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole kill rate. Look, we killed all these people. We must be winning the war.
Yeah.
When it's apparent from way up, apparently for a long time, they knew they were losing the war, like the whole time.
Right.
And yet they had all this, you know, quantifiable evidence about how well, how great it was all going.
Well, they had a ton of data, but not that much information.
Yeah. So it's like, well, what does that mean? I mean, quantifiable, I mean, they say too, it's like, you know, there's evidence that like sociopaths make great CEOs, you know what I mean? Does that mean people should become sociopaths, you know? And maybe we'll, you know, the world will run better and more efficiently, you know? It's like, I just think that it's kind of laughable.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, I think we should be careful about this because I think there is extensive evidence that mindfulness is helpful. I don't know about this article. I'd like to see it. This is one article.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I specifically wrote a paper, and has research been done here at UCSF about, you know, how helpful mindfulness is.
Uh-huh.
So I don't think we should, just because you're on the platform saying this is not the case, we should go with this.
Well, I didn't exactly say that.
Okay, well, it sounded like Jonathan was saying...
But
I agree with you. I think mindfulness is wonderful.
It's quite obvious that people have tried to make it into something it isn't.
Yeah.
And that was the focus of this study of studies, I guess it was.
Make it into
something it isn't, namely a heal all, whatever ails you, increase your prosperity and make more money, and you know it's being marketed that way. I'm sure you're aware of that.
Okay, yeah. No, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, they even use it in the military.
Right, and some of these studies apparently are on very shoddy methodological basis. And
I think what we should be more worried about is that people are using mindfulness for the wrong purposes, and it actually is helping people. And
yes.
It is helping.
Yes, as a Buddhist, I think, you know, I'm pretty aware of that.
Oh, okay.
So the point isn't that mindfulness isn't helpful. The point is that it has been turned into a marketing frenzy. And somewhat on the basis of research that turns out to be not very reliable. So that does not discount, obviously, an ancient practice like so-called mindfulness. An ancient practice like that is going to retain its power and its value for the people who practice it sincerely and with a proper guidance. But as a you know, as something, as a money maker for certain people, and those, some of those people are pointing to the certain research and saying, "See, this proves it." Actually, there's something amiss there. So, if I can find this article, I'll certainly send you a link. I don't recall if it was Newsweek, but something fairly big.
Somebody might debunk that article.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, so.
Yes?
I just want to make it clear, Max. I mean, I totally agree with you. I do think it's helpful. I was just laughing at the how this, you know, just quantifying things and selling it. And, I mean, that's why I said the monks, people have been doing it for thousands of years. Monks sleep. I mean, I love it. I mean, it's the backbone of my life. But, I mean, I think the ways in which, like, I mean, how does that prove? I mean, how are people proving that it's helpful? What are they using to measure how helpful it is, you know?
Well, back to the original point of Suzuki Roshi chanting Yakko in Japanese, and the American students saying, how is this helpful for my life?
Right.
And there's no way to quantify it directly. This is mystical.
Realistically mystical.
Yeah,
I would say.
I mean, I think there are definitely
practical
ways.
Okay, so it's 11 o'clock, so these our friends here who are building a house are going to start hammering any second. So
maybe, we were hammering at each other, we like that.
Yeah. So maybe we should continue our discussion upstairs. Okay. Thank you very much.